Good afternoon or good morning, depending on where you are in the country. My name is Robin Jones, and I'm one of our moderators for today's session. I want to welcome everyone to the Accessibility Online webinar series. This is a collaborative program that is operated between the ADA National Network and the U.S. Access Board. Our session today will run for 90 minutes. You'll have an opportunity to ask questions of our speakers, presenters. I also would like to remind you that this session is being recorded, and the recording will be made at a later date for individuals who may want to go back and review the information. Hopefully everyone was able to access the materials. They were on the website, the www.accessibilityonline.org website. After you logged in under your account name and password, you should have been able to access the session materials. This will be the same place that you will go to if you are after the session, once we've verified your attendance, to access your certificate of attendance or other continuing education recognition that you may have requested. Additional information will be available there for you. At this time, I'm going to close the chat room, and what I mean by that is I am just going to close the public side of the chat room. You are still able to send messages to our presenters at any time by just writing into the chat area itself. So at this time, I am going to be just taking away the chat area so that it's not public anymore. But again, you can continue to send messages. I see a question of somebody looking for the materials. The materials were posted on the website under the materials tab in your account manager. So if you go back into the website, you should be able to access those. Just again, a couple of things, housekeeping, before we go ahead and start. One is there is closed captioning available for this session. If you would click the CC icon at the top of your screen or on your keyboard, use Control F8. You will then get the dialog menu, and you can adjust your screen accordingly. Again, if you want to ask questions, type and submit your questions in the chat area box, or you can use the keyboard by pressing Control M and enter text in the chat area. The moderators and the presenters will be reviewing and monitoring that section throughout the presentation. During this time, we do ask you to refrain from using the emotions, little smiley face, things of that nature, and hand-raising features during the session. It can be distracting for people who are trying to pay attention and those that are using assistive technologies to access this webinar platform. We thank you very much in advance for that. So at this time, I am going to go ahead and turn over the microphone to Peggy Greenwell, who will go ahead and introduce our presenters and the session today. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin, and welcome everyone to our session on accessible health clubs and fitness facilities. Thanks for your participation today. I'll be presenting today along with Bill Botten, and so I'll give you a little information or a little background about myself first and then move on to Bill. I have been with the Access Board since 1992 and coordinated the board's efforts in developing accessibility guidelines for recreation facilities and have specialized in this area ever since. I have an undergraduate and graduate degree from the University of Maryland, and I also serve as the board's training coordinator. Bill Botten is a graduate of the University of Kansas. We try not to hold that against him, especially during basketball season. But he came to the board in 2000, and prior to that, he was the director of the Office of Accessible Seating for a national sports management company. So I'm going to be starting off today, and Bill will join in later in the session. I want to thank you in advance for some of the questions that you submitted. We're going to be answering those during the presentation. And as Robin said, you can submit questions to us as the session goes on, but we will not be able to respond to them until the end of the presentation. We'll have time for additional questions at that time as well. Okay, so moving on to slide 4. So here's our agenda today. We're going to first start off talking about the application of accessibility standards under both the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Architectural Barriers Act for federal facilities. So we're going to review first a little bit about how to apply the guidelines to newly constructed and altered facilities as well as existing facilities, which we know many people have lots of questions about. We're going to move from there to talking about some of the common features that you'd find in the health club or fitness facility, such as exercise equipment and machines, areas of sport activity, swimming pools, spas, and play areas. And then we're going to follow that with talking about some of the other elements within these facilities, such as entrances, parking, drinking fountains, toilet and bathing facilities, saunas, steam rooms, signs, counters, dressing and fitting and locker rooms. And here we're going to be highlighting what has changed from the 1991 standard to the 2010 standard under the ADA. And then finally we'll have time for some questions. Slide 5. Okay, so what we're addressing here are health clubs and fitness facilities, and there's been lots of questions about what types of facilities are covered. So here we're talking about facilities that would be covered by the ADA, whether that be under Title II for state and local government or Title III for places of public accommodation, as well as facilities covered under the Architectural Barriers Act, which covers federal facilities. So you can see the list here of potential facilities that are covered: health clubs, gyms, fitness facilities, personal training studios, employee fitness facilities. Those could be in state or local government or federal facilities or private sector. Local recreation centers, YMCAs. We had a couple questions that came in earlier about if not considered health clubs, do accessibility requirements apply to pools and exercise equipment in rooms at resorts and hotels? And the answer to that is yes, if they're covered by Title II or Title III of the ADA. There was another question, a similar question, just about how do these guidelines and rules apply to small fitness facilities like a hotel. And yeah, once again, they would be covered because they're covered under Title III, most likely of the ADA. Okay, slide 6. Just a follow-up on that earlier slide. Just the message here is that most of the facilities that we're talking about are covered by either the Americans with Disabilities Act or the Architectural Barriers Act. So what happened recently with the Americans with Disabilities Act is that the Department of Justice adopted new standards under the ADA, the 2010 accessibility standard, which replaced the 1991 standard. And as you know, the 2010 standard is consistent with the board's guidelines. Our revisions to the ADAG, or the 1991 standard, were finalized in 2004, and these new standards do include provisions for many of the spaces and elements that you find in health clubs and fitness facilities. I wanted to point out here the date here, the mandatory March 15, 2012. That's on or after that date is when all newly constructed and altered facilities need to comply with those standards. Keep in mind that this is a permit trigger date, not a design date. So if you are doing design work at this time, moving on to permitting, you might be aware of the March 15th deadline for that work. Slide 7. This is talking about the Architectural Barriers Act standard, which when we revise the ADA standards, we also revised the Architectural Barriers Act standards. They have been effective since May 8, 2006 under GSA for federal facilities. So they've been using these same standards for a number of years now. And again, they are consistent with the ADA standards. The only exception would be housing. The HUD and Urban Development has not yet adopted these standards, the new standards, and for facilities covered by HUD. So that's the only exception to federal facilities. Slide 8. So now we're going to talk about what this means for newly constructed, again, on or after March 15, 2012. Anything new must comply with the 2010 standard. Slide 9. So one of the things that we clarified in the 2010 standard was that all areas have to be accessible unless there's a specific exception or exemption, So we do have a list of exempted structures and spaces, and we'll talk about that, how that applies within these types of facilities, and or they are partially scoped spaces. So in this instance, instead of all of them being accessible, things required to be accessible, we're saying that a certain percentage or one of each type need to be accessible. So we'll also point that out to you in terms of how that is stated in the text. Slide 10. Okay, I just mentioned the general exceptions. Here's a list of a few that apply within some of the facilities that you may be dealing with in terms of health clubs or fitness facilities. We have exceptions for raised structures used solely for refereeing, judging, or scoring a sport, raised boxing or wrestling rings. When it comes to swimming pools, there's an exemption for water slides and raised diving boards, platforms. And then finally, animal containment area is not open to the public. You may or may not have that in one of these facilities, but I'm just pointing that out as it related to recreation facilities. Slide 11. Okay, so moving on again, talking about new construction, you first need to go to Chapter 2. Chapter 2 covers all the scoping provisions. And there I'm going to highlight the scoping provisions that are directed to these types of facilities and elements. So whether you're dealing with an ADA facility or Architectural Barriers Act facility, you're going to be dealing with Chapter 2. And in yellow here, I've noted some of those scoping provisions. And the next slide, slide 12, I've given you the numbers of some of the scoping provisions that are applied within some of these spaces. For example, the exempted spaces I just spoke about, are contained in Chapter 2, Chapter 203, or provision number 203 in Chapter 2. 222 addresses dressing, fitting, and locker rooms. 225, storage facilities, lockers. Exercise equipment and machines is 236. 240 is where you find all the scoping provisions for play areas. 241, saunas and steam rooms. And then finally, 242 is where you'd find swimming pool, wading pools, and spa. Now, for those of you using our ADA, ABA guidelines and you're dealing with a federal facility, you would use these same provision numbers, only they would be noted with an F next to it. That means you're in the federal facility scoping chapter. Okay, slide 13. The technical provisions for all of these different elements are located in Chapter 10. So what Chapter 2 will tell you in relevant scoping provisions is that when it comes to accessible swimming pools, for example, you need to provide a certain number of accessible means of access into the water. And those means are then, there's means of access in the water are then contained in the technical provisions, and there'll be specific provisions for each means of access into the water. For example, swimming pool lifts or sloped entry will all be addressed there. Same thing for exercise equipment and machines. The technical provisions for the actual exercise machine would be in Chapter 10. Moving on to slide 14. Okay, now we're going to talk about alterations, and this is when you decide that you're going to renovate or alter a facility. Slide 15. So the basic application here is that the standards apply based on the planned scope of work that you are undertaking. So if you're doing work on a toilet room, then you need to follow the toilet room provisions and make it accessible. That's what your planned scope of work is. Now there's two other components to alterations that we just want to highlight here. One is if you're doing an alteration in an area of primary function, triggering the path of travel requirement, and also the notion of technical and feasibility, which is also only pertains to alterations. And I'm going to go into a little bit more detail of both of those on the next slides. Slide 16. So when you do an alteration to an area containing primary function, and here's some examples of areas that you might have in your facilities, a group exercise room in a health club, a pool in a rec center, or exercise equipment in a fitness facilities, this would trigger the path of travel requirement because you're doing an alteration in the area of primary function. this path of travel requirement would not be triggered, for example, if you were doing an alteration to a toilet room. That's not the primary function space. It is these other spaces noted here. Slide 17. So when you're doing an alteration to an area of primary function, you have a required accessible path of travel to the area that is being altered. And the idea behind this is that you provide an accessible path of travel so that people with disabilities can benefit from that newly altered accessible space. And that path of travel includes an accessible route from the site arrival point outside of the facility, parking, building entrances, restrooms, phones, and drinking fountains along the way. Slide 18. This shows you kind of a diagram of what this might look like in a facility where you have a parking outside a facility entrance. You are moving along the route to the primary function area, which has been altered. You have drinking fountains and toilet facilities along the way. So that's what gets triggered where you're, again, doing an alteration to, it's an additional requirement on top of making the space that you're altering accessible. Slide 19. There is a disproportionate level established for this path of travel. And basically, it's a limit to how much you have to spend on this path of travel. And the requirement is that compliance is required except where it's disproportionate to the project costs more than 20%. This is, again, under the 20 under the ADA, and that is established under the ADA, by the Attorney General. It's also the same provision under the Architectural Barriers Act and established by the General Services Administration. Slide 20, just to wrap up on alterations, this notion of technical infeasibility is a part of any alteration or can be considered when doing an alteration. This is not a part of new construction. Basically, what it says is that when you're doing an alteration to an existing facility, you may have constraints that prohibit, physical or site constraints that prohibit compliance. And an example that's provided is removing a fixture to create an accessible stall may conflict with your plumbing code. This is an example of technical infeasibility. In this case, what is expected is that you do the best you can in meeting the technical provisions for that particular alteration. Okay, now moving on, slide 21 to existing facilities. And slide 22. We're talking about what standards apply to ADA existing facilities. So first off, you have to distinguish between whether you're covered under Title II or Title III. Title II applies to state and local governments. And here, when it comes to program accessibility, the idea is that you must view your program of health clubs or fitness facilities in their entirety and determine whether or not you can achieve program accessibility for all of the programs when viewed in their entirety. This may or may not mean that all existing health club or fitness facilities would be accessible. Again, you need to achieve it when viewed in its entirety. When it comes to Title III entities, existing facilities, the idea is, or the requirement is for readily achievable barrier removal. This is thought of as easy, something that is easy to accomplish without much difficulty or expense. It's not intended to put people out of business, but it is an ongoing obligation, and it's important that you are aware of the barriers that you have in your facility and that you work to remove them over time. This obligation for existing facilities has been part of the ADA for more than 20 years, there's never been a grandfathering in a facility. But again, existing facilities aren't treated in the same way as newly constructed or altered facilities. If you have any questions about existing facilities, you really should direct those questions to the Department of Justice. And I've noted their number here, 800-514-0301. Slide 23. So when the Department of Justice adopted the new standards, they had to tell you what this meant with respect to existing facilities, since you have obligations for existing facilities. And basically, what they said is that if you met the 1991 standard in your facility, then you don't need to alter your facility to bring it up to the 2010 standard. What they added to that was, and they called that a safe harbor, what they added to that is that the safe harbor didn't apply to elements in existing facilities that were not part of the 1991 standard. And that happens to include most of the elements and facilities that we're going to be talking about today. Slide 24. So here's a list of the elements that were not subject to the safe harbor. And as you can see here in the list is exercise equipment and machines, play areas, sauna, steam rooms, swimming pools, wading pools, and spas. Those were things that were not in the 1991 standard and are not subject to the safe harbor. So basically what that means is these are elements and features that need to be added onto the list of areas that you need to work towards achieving program accessibility or readily achievable barrier removal. Again, where you have questions about existing facilities, we need you to direct those, and what your obligations are, we need you to direct those to the Department of Justice at 800-514-0301. Okay, slide 25. Now we're going to move on to some of the common elements that you might find within health clubs, fitness facilities. And we're going to start off with slide 26, talking about exercise equipment and machines. The requirement here is that one of each type of these would be accessible. So you have a floor plan here of a number of different types of exercise equipment, most of them being cardiovascular equipment, but they're different types. The first row there are a row of elliptical machines, so one of those would have to be accessible. On the second row from the top would be a row of treadmills. That would be one type. On the last row, you have on one side a stair climbers, and on the left-hand side and on the right-hand side, you have stationary bikes. Those are all different types. So you have four different types of exercise equipment here. And so each, again, one of each type would be required to be accessible. What this also translates to is for most strength training equipment, they would be considered different types. The only exception to that is where you might have the same type of machine, only it's made by a different manufacturer. So you have two different bicep curl machines. They're just made by different manufacturers. In that case, only one of those would need to be accessible. Slide 27. Now what we mean when we say need to be accessible, the requirement is that you have a clear space adjacent to the equipment. That has to be positioned, that clear space has to be a minimum of 30 by 48 inches. It has to be either positioned for transfer, so the space is positioned so that one could transfer from their mobility device onto a seat or onto the element, or for use by an individual using a wheelchair. And you see on the top right there image of an individual who is using a piece of equipment from their chair. So in that case, you have the clear space positioned accordingly. The other notion about clear floor space is that it can be shared between two. One or more piece can share that. It can overlap. So you see in the bottom center there, an example of how one clear space is shared between two pieces of equipment. So much of this requirement pertains to the way a facility is laid out and achieving these space requirements. Slide 28. So you have another image here of the layout of a facility with different pieces of equipment in a single room. I wanted to note here that there is no requirement to modify the equipment. We have a requirement for the space adjacent to it. We have also exempted the controls and operating mechanisms from provisions that would limit, for example, the pounds per force to use. Now, the usability of a piece of equipment is something that is important to people with disabilities and to everyone. And there, outside of the board, there are several efforts that are underway through the ASTM, American Society of Testing and Materials, and the Inclusive Fitness Council of the National Center on Physical Activity and Disability, where they're looking at ways to improve the usability of the equipment for people who are visually impaired and hearing impaired and have physical disabilities. So they're looking at, you know, just the way the instructions that one has to use to operate the equipment, the size of the fonts, the operating mechanisms themselves to, you know, really improve on the usability. So you can look to those two groups to get guidance in that area if you're looking at this issue in your facility. They are also trying to educate manufacturers about this issue as well. And so you can refer people who are interested in that part of it to them. Okay, slide 29. Another area that we identified in doing rulemaking in this area was identifying a space called the area of sport activity. And here, what we're talking about, and this is to address any type of sports field, court sports, et cetera. The definition of an area of sport activity is that portion of a room or space where the play or practice of sport occurs. So rather than list all the different areas, and we would most likely leave something out of the list, we have netted all of those types of facilities into this area of sport activity definition. So that's what you should look to in terms of your requirements, where you're looking at any kind of sports field. You look to the area of sport activity to guide you. Slide 30. So here we noted that where you have multiple tennis courts, for example, there has to be space enough between the courts to allow for passage so that you're not requiring someone to go all around all the courts when, you know, all they're trying to do is change the sides. So this is a photo of one that you see that has adequate space between it, but this has specifically been called out in the provision so as to avoid, you know, putting those the passage too close so that someone has to go around multiple courts when changing sides. 31. So that area of sport activity, the requirement is that there be an accessible route to each area of sport activity. And you see here an image of a sports complex with multiple fields, sports fields. And in fact, we've noted some of them. There are even more than are noted on this this image. The arrows, the yellow arrows are indicating those different types, those different sports fields. So the requirement is that an accessible route connect each area sport activity. Now, there are specific requirements that pertain to the accessible route, and it gets you to that area sport activity. But once inside the area sport activity, there are no other requirements that apply, no other accessibility requirements. We're not trying to change the way the sport is played or the way that the field is designed. This is only geared towards allowing people to get to that area of sport activity. Slide 32. So we're moving on to swimming pools now, where you might have that in your facility. The requirement here is that if you have a swimming pool that's over 300 linear feet of pool wall, you have to have two means of access. One of those means of access has to be either a sloped or a sloped entry or a lift. If you're less than 300 linear feet of pool wall, then you have to have either a lift or a sloped entry. We did have a question that came in earlier. It says a pool provides a wonderful exercise option for people with limited mobility. However, steps and ladders may not provide adequate access to enter and exit the pool. are there requirements for privately owned health and exercise clubs to provide this access? And if so, what are the compliance timeframes for retrofitting existing facilities? Well, I earlier mentioned the requirements for existing facilities. So let's say that you have an existing swimming pool. It doesn't have any access into the water. Let's say that you're a private entity, then your requirement is readily achievable barrier removal. So you need to first identify what your barrier is and work towards providing access into the water, whether that be providing a swimming pool lift, or if you know in the near future you're going to be doing some sort of construction work on that pool, that you can incorporate a sloped entry. So that's precisely what is required for access to this type of facility. The compliance time frame, it's an ongoing obligation. So, it's going to be dependent on each different facility, what kind of resources that you have, what is readily achievable for your particular facility. Okay, slide 33. And this is just a chart to show you the different means of access that are required for the various facilities. I just mentioned the ones for swimming pools. The larger swimming pools that are 300 or more linear feet, the sloped entry and lift, it has to be one of them, but there are options. There are three other options to add to that, transfer walls, transfer systems, and stairs. For wave action pools, leisure rivers, and other pools where the user is limited to one area, entry is limited to one area, it's limited to sloped entry, lift, and transfer systems. For wading pools, there's only the one option of sloped entry, and for spas, we have limited the access to lifts, transfer walls, and transfer systems. Slide 34. So now I'm going to go through some of the specific criteria for these means of access into the water. The first being sloped entry. Basically, the sloped entry needs to extend to between 24 and 30 inches below the stationary water level. And there's a maximum 1 in 12 slope required on that entry. We would recommend a lesser slope where possible. It's very difficult to coming up through up a sloped entry in the water with that much of a slope. So lesser slope is always desired. Handrails are required on the sloped entry, and they need to be located between 33 and 38 inches. And that's the criteria for the sloped entry itself. Slide 35. So moving on to pool lifts. Basically, the pool lifts, where provided, if this is selected as your means of access into the water, they need to extend, or they need to be located where the water doesn't exceed 48 inches. And this is included here so that if someone wanted to provide assistance to someone who has used a pool lift into the water, they would be able to stand in the water. Now, we do have an exception that says if the entire pool is greater than 48 inches, then, of course, you don't have to comply with this. But this is where you have variable depths in the water, then we want you to locate the lift in less than 48 inches. Footrests, which are very important for balance on swimming pool lifts, must be provided, and they must move with the seat. Not shown on this slide here is a requirement for a clear space adjacent to the lift on the deck, and that is a 36 by 48 space that is parallel with the seat. Slide 36. Armrests are also, if provided, they're not required, but if they are provided, they have to be opposite the water and shall be removable or fold in raised and load position. And then finally, this lift has to be capable of unassisted operation from both the deck and the water level. That doesn't mean that you can't provide assistance. It just means that the design of the lift has to be capable of unassisted operation. So a hand crank lift will not meet this requirement. Slide 37. Okay, another option, this is a secondary means, again, only permitted where you have a larger pool and you have to have two means. You can provide a transfer wall, which is basically a raised pool edge. And the idea here is that the height of that pool edge would be between 16 and 19 inches, that you have a clear deck space between 60 and 60, that's level, allowing someone to transfer onto the pool edge and enter the water. Slide 38 shows a transfer system is another option for secondary access, and here it's basically a platform system with steps that allows you to transfer from your chair onto a platform and use the steps to enter the water. The technical provisions require that the platform be 19 inches minimum in depth, 24 inches clear width, and 16 to 19 inches in height. The surface needs to be smooth, not sharp, and have rounded edges, since someone is going to be moving on that surface. Slide 39. And finally, another secondary means of access is pool stairs. And here, we're talking about stairs that would actually comply with the stairs provisions we have in the building standards, which means it couldn't be a recessed stair. It would have to look more like a stair that you would see on a facility. Here we're looking at a use by someone who is ambulatory, and the handrails with a pretty narrow width, allowing the idea or the chance for support while entering or exiting the water. We have exempted the extension at the bottom of the handrail, which is normally required on stairs. In this case, we have exempted that extension for pool stairs. Okay, moving on to slide 40. We're looking here at spas. The requirement is that you have at least one means of entry, whether it's a lift, transfer wall, or transfer system. If you have a lift, the footrests are not required for this application in this spa. Where you have a multiple spas in a cluster, the requirement is 5%, but not less than one. Moving on to slide 41, talking about wading pools. Here, the only option prescribed is a sloped entry. And in this case, there is not a requirement for handrails. The sloped entry must extend to the deepest part of the wading pool. There is a conscious effort here not to add any elevation to the wading pool area for obvious reasons. So the sloped entry really is the only option for providing direct access. Slide 42 is highlighting the exception I mentioned earlier, which is that there is not a requirement for access to diving boards and raised diving platforms or other platforms. Slide 43, moving on to water play components. This is where you might have these components might be associated with the pool, or they may be standalone. Basically, where you have a play structure that is in water. The requirement, and also I should mention, these are structures that have elevated play components. What we're saying here is that for these structures, ramp access is not required to the elevated play components, but transfer access is required. And I'm going to also review a little bit about the transfer access in a moment here, but basically, again, ramp access is not required for these water play components where you have elevated play components. Slide 44. So generally for play areas, and this is a very abbreviated review of what's required for play areas, we have had a separate webinar on play areas and for that matter on swimming pools. So if you want to get more specifics about either of those elements, you can go back to the archives of these webinars and look this up. But basically for play areas, the requirement is that one of each type of ground level play component be accessible. Where you have elevated play components, 50% of them need to be accessible. And when it comes to access to the elevated structure, Ramp access is required only where you have more than 20 elevated components. Where you have less than 20 elevated components, you have to have transfer access. So it's more like a transfer system that you might find in a swimming pool. That's what's required in the play area. And then moving on to slide 45, we also addressed soft contained play structures. Again, may or may not be part of your facilities. And here the requirement is simply to get to the entry point and making sure that entry point is on an accessible route and no other accessibility requirements apply once inside that structure. And that's where really all the play is inside of the structure. So if you have three or fewer entry points, you'd have to have one of the entry points on an accessible route. Four or more, you would have to have two. We have some very specific technical assistance material on play areas, on swimming pools, on sports facilities. Bill is going to show you some of that, what those documents look like at the end. And at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Bill, who's going to give you some more review of the other elements that you might find within your building facility.
Thank you, Peggy. I'm going to pick up with other facility elements, and the elements that I'm going to work through here are elements that we felt were important to discuss and that are changes in the 2010 standard. And these elements are key elements and can break or make or break the experience of a person with a disability being able to participate at these types of facilities. Many times, if the entrance or parking is not available for a person with a disability, it will oftentimes make it an inaccessible facility to attempt to even participate in the programs or some of the services within the facility. Moving on to slide 47. I'd like to start with entrances, and the scoping requirement for entrances is at least 60% of the public entrances must comply and be an accessible route. So if there are two entrances into a building, it would mean both of them. Additionally, if there's a direct access from a parking structure, all the access from each level or parking structures must comply or be an accessible route. It also requires that where direct access from tunnels or elevated walkways, at least one of each must be provided to provide an accessible route to those facilities. Entrances into different tenant spaces, at least one entrance into each tenant space within the facility is required. And finally, restricted or secured entrances always requires a minimum of one accessible way in and out of a facility. So if you're providing a secured entrance at your health or fitness center, that you would make sure that the minimum clearances along the accessible route are available at least at one location. Slide 47. I'm sorry, 48. Slide 48 is a photograph of a gentleman using a mobility device, a wheelchair, depressing a automatic door opener. And automatic door openers are recommended for exterior doors. The standard currently does not have a pounds per force requirement on exterior doors, but the weight of an exterior door can make it more difficult or not independently usable by some individuals with disabilities that may be trying to attend or participate at programs or use the services at a facility. And another consideration is that if you're in a climate where doors in series are common, that you make sure that the clearances required between those two doors meets the requirements found in the standard, that oftentimes limited space between doors in series can make it very difficult to enter a facility. I'd also like to highlight that the location of an accessible route into a facility has to coincide with the common or general circulation path, and that where an interior circulation path is provided, it also has to provide an accessible route interior. On entrances, I'd also like to highlight one of the questions that we got, and that was, it was a question involving a revolving door, and a revolving door was not used to the entrance of the facility, but actually to separate a swimming pool area from the recreation or health club facility to try to keep, I guess, the humidity or other the difference in climate between the two spaces apart. Revolving doors cannot be used as part of an accessible route. Revolving gates or turnstiles are not permitted as part of an accessible route. And another door, an auxiliary door, would have to be provided along with a revolving door. Slide 49, please. I'd like to move to accessible vehicle parking, and there's been several changes in the 2010 standard involving accessible vehicle parking. And again, this is an area where it can really make the difference of whether or not an individual will have an opportunity to attend this facility if the parking is not compliant. Parking is, the scoping requirements is determined by a parking table, which is highlighted in the slide I'm showing right now, along with a photograph of an accessible parking space. This slide highlights that based on the number of parking spaces provided in the facility, it triggers a minimum number of accessible spaces. One of the changes in the 2010 standard was an increase in the number of van accessible spaces required. The 1990 standard required that one of every 8 accessible spaces be a van space. In the 2010 standard, it requires that one of every 6 be a van space. Remember, the van space has an increased size of the access aisle. The access aisle is a minimum of 8 feet. That allows for a person to deploy a lift and also get on and off that lift without striking or being interfered with a vehicle in an adjacent space. Slide 50. Slide 50 shows has an illustration of an accessible parking sign, and I was watching the comments coming in as Peggy was speaking, and one of the issues that was brought up was, is it required to have the fine amount and that an individual will be towed away on the parking sign? And it is not a requirement of the standard to provide that on a signage. It may be something that is a local or a local jurisdiction may have additional requirements, but the standard requires that the international symbol be placed on the sign and that there be an additional sign or it be included in the sign where van accessible spaces are located. So some of the clarifications and revisions into the parking requirements are that the access aisle be marked, and the method or color is not specified by the standard, may be addressed by state or local laws. The sign is now required to have a minimum height to the bottom of the sign of 60 inches, and that where angled spaces, and specifically angled van spaces, are provided, that the passenger side have the access aisle. Again, most vehicles that have a lift deploy the lift from the passenger side, and if the space is angled and not permitted, you know, forward or backing into a space, that this would allow for those vans to use the van accessible space. Slide 51, please. I'm going to move from parking into drinking fountains, and a change in the drinking fountain requirements is that where drinking fountains are provided, whether they're interior or exterior, that now 2 units be required, one for individuals using mobility devices or wheelchairs, and then one for persons standing. So in multiple locations, 50% of each type is required. Where the 50% of drinking fountains yields a fraction, 50% shall be permitted to be rounded either up or down, provided that the total number of accessible compliant drinking fountains equals 100% or all of them. Another requirement that I wanted to highlight was that the spout height for the low drinking fountain is at 36 inches maximum, and the high unit, the range is between 38 and 43. I'd also like to highlight that one unit could be used. An alternative is to use a single drinking fountain that provides the high and low access. Slide 52. From here, I'd like to move into toilet and bathing rooms. And these these again are facilities or segments or spaces within these facilities that are essential in order for individuals to be able to participate in these types of facilities. Slide 53. I'd like to say that the scoping requirements are found in Chapter 2, and all your plumbing requirements are found in Chapter 6. And the first slide is a figure that shows the door swing, and the door swing is outside the clearance fixtures. And slide 54 further addresses the same issue. If I could get to slide 54, it shows that that door can swing through the fixture clearances as long as a clear floor space is provided outside of the swing of the door. And here it's depicted by a yellow rectangle within this this toilet or bathing or dressing room. And you can see here that that door swing is outside or not interfering with where an individual could sit. This is so important that if an individual gets into this small space, that there's an opportunity to open that door and there's enough space to get out of the way of the door so that then you could exit from this small space. Slide 55. One of the common errors and what was permitted in the 1990 version was that the standard permitted the lavatory to overlap the clear floor space of the water closet. And this is a photo that depicts that lavatory very close to the water closet. And in the new standard, slide 56 shows the space adjacent to the water closet. So the water closet clearance requirement is 60 by 56 minimum, and this would allow for the person with a mobility device to position that in order to transfer in a number of different ways, whether it be a parallel or side-by-side lateral transfer, come at it at a diagonal, but it increases the amount of space that would be available for an individual to be able to use the water closet. Slide 57. Slide 57 shows an alternative to moving the lavatory away from the water closet is to recess it. And the standard permits a shorter grab bar along the rear wall in this case. I want to remind you that if an element is put into an alcove, such as this lavatory in the figure is shown, that the clear space around that element, based on how far back it is, the alcove size increases. And so it could increase the clear floor space from a minimum of 30 inches wide to 36 inches wide or even larger, based on the approach and how deep it is recessed. But this could allow you to shorten or minimize the size of the room, but still provide these features and be very accessible. Slide 58. Slide 58 starts to leaves the restroom or toilet facilities and moves into bathing facilities. And after a workout, most people like to either change and dress and groom and have an opportunity to bathe before they re-enter the workforce or leave to go somewhere else or even leave to go home. And so slide 59 begins the bathing facilities. And access to all public and common use facilities, including things like the employee locker rooms, the pool shower rooms, the gymnasium. And I'd like to highlight that even if gang showers are provided, that at least one shower or tub is required. And it provides three different options, whether that be a roll-in shower, a transfer shower, stall, or a tub. And I'm going to highlight two of these different options, the transfer shower and the roll-in shower, in the upcoming slides. Slide 60. This is a photograph of what I call the Cadillac of transfer stalls. It shows a large L-shaped bench. It shows the controls in the right location. It shows the seat with a very large padding on it that helps facilitate individuals that may have skin issues based on long periods of time being seated. It provides a location for the soap and that very close to the seat. And so at this point, I'm going to move forward and show you and talk to you about some of the specific requirements that are required for a transfer stall. Slide 61. So this is one of the few places that the standard requires an absolute dimension. This transfer stall is a 36 by 36 clear inside dimension measured at the center points of opposing sides, and also must have at least must have an absolute 36 inch wide minimum entry at the face of the shower compartment. This also shows that the grab bars could be either be continuous or they could be split. You see them split on the left side, and you see that they extend a minimum, or they extend an absolute of 18 inches from the corner if it's continuous. Slide 62. So slide 62 shows the same shower compartment photo that I showed earlier, and it talks about the dimensions and the location, but I'd like to talk about the seat height being 17 to 19 inches, that it could be folding, it could be fixed. It does have to support at least 250 pounds of structural strength, and that securement must be to that seat wall. I'm going to go further with the next slide and talk about the dimensions and locations on slide 63. So the new standards specifications for both L-shaped and rectangular seats, and you can see by the figures included in this slide, it talks about the distance away from the wall. If you're on the seat wall, it's typically 2.5 inches for both the L-shaped and the rectangular. The L-shaped seat has a 15 to 16 inch range for the long end of the seat and a 14 to 15 inch depth on the short end. It also requires that the maximum or the length of the L-shaped piece be 20 to 23 inches, whereas the rectangular seat is a little bit smaller. It's only 15 to 16 inches in depth, and I really believe that the L-shaped bench provides greater opportunity for a wider variety of people with all abilities in that it's more space. For a person that doesn't have use of their lower extremities, many times in a wet environment it can feel like you're sliding off and you're all soapy. And to have a seat only 15 to 16 inches sometimes can feel a little unstable. So I believe that the L-shaped seat, where you can actually back yourself into the corner and use the whole L-shape to, in many cases, put your shampoo or soap, but also lean into the corner if you don't have good stability in your trunk, that you can kind of brace yourself back in the corner on an L-shaped type seat. You can see that on the sidewall, the requirement is that the gap between the wall and the seat itself be no greater than 1.5 inches, and again on the seat wall you can have up to 2.5 inches. Slide 64. Slide 64 shows the alignment, the clear floor space alignment, and the clearance of 38 by 48 inches long minimum is measured from the control wall and must be provided. So here you see that 48 inches starts at the control wall at the right side of this figure and goes back past that absolute dimension of the transfer stall of 36, another 12 inches to 48. And that offset allows for the positioning of the mobility device for a lateral transfer. Because this transfer stall would have the opportunity to have a curb up to 2 inches, so that mobility device wouldn't have the opportunity to diagonally enter the transfer stall. So you need to be able to position your mobility device for that lateral transfer. Most wheelchair wheels are around 24 inches, and so that additional 12 inches behind the seat gets you half of the wheel back, as you see in this figure, where the shoulder alignment lines up with this transfer stall seat. Slide 65. Slide 65 is a cutaway version of this transfer stall and shows the control location. It's required to be near the opening and usable from outside the stall. So many times in a lot of the facilities you go to, the water could be very cold or very hot right from the very start. And it's many times important for persons that don't have sensitivity of their extremities to be able to understand how cold or how hot it's going to be before they turn it on. And so this would allow someone to get up to the edge, turn it on, feel maybe when the water's to a right temperature, and then transfer in and use it from there forward. So the control wall location, again, is 15 inches maximum above, 15 inches maximum inside that front edge wall, above the grab bar between 38 and 48 inches. Slide 66. Slide 66 moves us from the transfer shower to a roll-in shower with no seat. And on a transfer shower with no seat, you can see that the lavatory can overlap that outside space. It's anticipated that there would still be enough space for the maneuvering in and out of that space so that you could still get your mobility device all the way in there or transfer to a portable or removable type bench. You can also see that there are three grab bars on this roll-in shower with no seat. So in the new standard, the clear floor space has been reduced in the shower itself from 36 inches down to 30 inches, but the clear space still requires a minimum of 60 inches. You could still keep this at 36 inches in the minimum depth requirement, and I do think that the larger these roll-in showers with no seats are, the more flexibility it provides so that if someone were to bring, say, their own shower chair, was a very large person, used a shower bench in a different position to where they had an opportunity to transfer to their strong side, it provides a great deal of flexibility. Slide 67. As I stated earlier, if you have a roll-in shower with no seat, it permits that the grab bars, or requires that the grab bars be provided on all three walls, but it also provides that the shower head and controls could be on all or any of the three walls provided. And again, this provides greater flexibility during the design phase, but also could provide greater flexibility to the user based on specific strengths or weaknesses. Slide 68. Slide 68 shows where the controls are on that long wall here, but it could be on any of the side walls also, as we earlier talked about, but it is located above the grab bar within the reach ranges, no higher than 48 inches. So above the grab bar, no higher than 48 inches is where you'd find the controls on any one of the three walls in a roll-in shower where there's no seat provided. Slide 69. Again, we're still in the roll-in shower, but now we've added the seat. This figure shows where the controls would be located in a roll-in shower with a seat. And there is a 27-inch maximum distance and an area above the grab bar, no higher than 48 inches, where the control or operating mechanism needs to be. Now, I've operated many of these, and when the controls are all the way back in the corner, as I talked to you earlier about how the L-shaped seat really functions, that if you can position yourself back in the corner, many times that control is right at your shoulder, and it's difficult to keep it in the on position if it's one of those that you push and pull out or turn from one side to the other and have to pull it out. It can be difficult. I honestly suggest that moving it a little bit out of the corner is more optimal, and that not outside that 27 maximum, but that you move it a little bit outside the corner, away from the seat itself, so it's easier to reach. Slide 70. I can't tell you how many times this is me. This is a really common mistake, is that the controls are put on the opposite wall of the seat. And as you see in this slide also, there's a grab bar immediately behind the bench, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that later. But this can make it very dangerous, especially when you're wet. And many times I'll have to adjust the water controls or the temperature, turn it on, try shove that shower, handheld shower, down between the grab bars, and many times there's not an on-off switch to the handheld shower unit. And I'll end up shoving it down, wrapped in a towel around the grab bar, getting on the seat, and then hoping that the temperature and the volume of spray is what I desired. And with the minimum length of the handheld shower cord, it barely reaches long enough out to use. And so this is one highlighted issue when there is a seat provided, how important it is where the location of the controls and operating mechanisms are. Slide 71. many times there's a drain, or the floor has been sloped up to provide access into a roll-in shower, and the slope of the floor is right where a person is trying to leave their mobility device and transfer from. There are no curbs. A smooth transition to the shower floor is what's required. The new standard says that a half-inch maximum beveled curb is allowed. I've seen all kinds of rubber curbing that's been used to try to retain the water inside. I do think a shower curtain is the best way to go, and if it's longer, to retain some of the water, make it longer and even wider than the space so that it can kind of overlap the mobility device so you can have it within a reach from the seat. The slope requirement of that floor is no greater than 2%. And one way to handle that water from escaping out of that shower area would be to put in a trench drain. The one shown is an older model. They make some really nice 1-inch recessed trench drains at this time that can be flush with the surface and retain the water that hits the curtain and that is rolling on the floor towards the rest of the restroom. Slide 72, please. An alternative to the roll-in shower that's provided in the 2010 standard is an alternate roll-in transfer type shower. And this kind of brings the benefits of both the roll-in shower and the transfer shower. One of the great things about a transfer shower is that it is actually kind of confining and that you can't fall too far, or that if you have spasticity in your lower extremities that your legs can't extend or actually go too far, and you're kind of confined in the space so that you feel more secure. And this type of roll-in alternative transfer shower provides all the benefits of both. It can make it more difficult if you have a caregiver or someone that's trying to help facilitate that transfer onto the bench to have enough space to get in there and really work with someone. That's where the actual roll-in shower, maybe with no seat, is better. But if you're able to independently transfer, this is a great way to use a shower, this alternative transfer. That opening minimum is 36 inches. You still have the 60-inch minimum length and a depth of 36 inches. You see grab bars on two of the walls and the placement of a fixed bench here. The one thing I like about this is that if you, in the next slide here, in slide 73 shows, where the person is actually, this is a figure that depicts an individual with a mobility device, actually a wheelchair, that has entered into the alternate roll-in transfer type shower and then has enough space to transfer laterally, as we talked about with the transfer shower that's an absolute 36 by 36. Many times what you can do is leave your mobility device right there while you shower, because the shower curtain comes across that opening. You leave it all the way to the end, close to the seat, but you just throw it up over onto your mobility device, and it makes it so that you don't have to worry about your mobility device rolling away or it getting wet, and it's still within an arm's reach. So a lot of times it still allows for kind of a diagonal approach to the seating bench, but I find the alternative roll-in transfer type shower very, very useful. Slide 74. Slide 74 is cutaway view and again an overhead view of this alternative roll-in shower, and it shows the location of the controls and shower head. It shows it on the sidewall adjacent to the seat at 27 inches maximum away from the corner, again above the grab bar at no higher than 48 inches maximum. Again, placing that control right in the corner makes it more difficult to use, and more oftentimes than not, you hit it or bump it when you're transferring or maneuvering in the shower and trying to use the facility. Slide 75. This shows an alternate location on the back wall for the controls. Again, it would be above the grab bar. It would be no higher than 48 inches, but similar to what we saw in the 36 by 36 inch transfer shower, here we see the control mechanism directly across from where you're seated, and I really like this location. It's 15 inches maximum. You see the requirement there, again, above the grab bar, no higher than 48 inches. Slide 76. Slide 76 talks about this handheld shower spray unit. It does require that it have an on and off switch on it. Typically that's on the handle. It's kind of a toggle switch that allows it to be turned on and off. The water to temperature requirement is no hotter than 120 degrees. There is an exception that you would not have to provide the handheld shower spray unit if you had a fixed shower head located 48 inches maximum. Above the clear floor ground space. It requires that the length of the hose be 59 inches minimum. I honestly think that longer is better. One of the things I find in most facilities I go to is that an individual has used this shower spray unit as a normal shower in a fixed position all the way at the top. And this photo that's enclosed in this slide shows the controls very close to the mounting bracket of where the handheld unit can be positioned and used from. That's a really important thing. A lot of times they're put on a slide pole and an individual has used them and they're left all the way at the top, and it can be very difficult to ever get it to release or bring it down to a fixed position in the lower position. And so if cleaning staff would at least put it in the middle range, no higher than 48 inches, it would really help facilitate independent access. Many times when I go into a facility, I have to call housekeeping or some type of staff to have that lowered to be able to be operable. Look at the locations of where this is being mounted. Imagine yourself sitting on the seat or on a transfer bench and how you'd want to use this handheld. You know that many times if you release it and it's still going, it's going to fly all over the place. So look at where you could actually clip it and use it like a stationary overhead shower for someone that's seated. Slide 77 shows a photograph of some of the common errors that we've already talked about, and that is a grab bar immediately behind the seat. This also shows the controls below the grab bar, which, again, we've talked about, needs to be above the grab bar and within 48-inch reach from the clear floor space. This shows the bench folded up in the up position, but it is very difficult to maintain yourself on a 15 to 16-inch bench when you have a grab bar sticking 3 inches out in the middle of your back. It is a common error, but remember that if there's a seat provided, grab bars are not required on all three walls, only on two walls. Slide 78 brings us to the saunas and steam rooms. Saunas and steam rooms where provided in a cluster, if you have multiple ones, 5%, but no less than one. It requires that a turning space within the room be provided, but that it could be obstructed by benches that are removable or readily removable seats, and that the door cannot swing into the clear floor or ground space for the bench. We had a question that came in that talked about access to a steam room or sauna are required should a facility provide special wheelchairs, since metal in those rooms would get too hot. And most mobility devices are made of aluminum, and aluminum does absorb the temperature in the surrounding area very quickly. I would recommend that there be an alternative to leaving one's mobility device, especially one that had enclosed batteries or any type of electrical system within the steam room. But the 2010 standard don't specifically address the operational issues of whether or not an aquatic type wheelchair would be required by the facility. But it may be something that you would want to consider if you were the facility manager at a site that did have a sauna or steam room. Slide 79. Signage. Signage is very important and allows individuals with visual disabilities the opportunity to understand what's in the room or what's available for them to have an opportunity to understand what's available. There's several different types of signs that I'd like to discuss, and the first one is tactile signs, where you would find them as maybe restrooms or the labels or room numbers or floor levels or exit access. And those tactile would be raised lettering, would include raised characters, pictograms, and grade 2 braille. Visual-only signs would be the directional or informational type signage. There's a requirement for finish and contrast and line spacing and character heights, and there's a lot of different specific issues when providing signage. Also, for visual only, there's a requirement based font size based on the viewing distance. And finally, temporary signs, building menus, directories, addresses, company names and logos are exempt from the signage requirements found in Chapter 7. Slide 80. We had, I've just noticed that the first bullet point on the sign, slide 79, talks about the door cannot swing into the clear floor or ground space of the bench, and that was actually from the previous slide that was for saunas and steam rooms, and we talked about that as the last bullet point on slide 78, and so I just wanted to highlight that it was brought forward accidentally onto the sign slide also. Slide 80 talks about the sales and service counters. The sales and service counters are a very important and an issue that I would like to highlight here, that the accessible portion have a maximum height of 36 inches and that you could provide either a forward or a parallel approach. If you provided a forward approach, knee and toe clearance would be required, and only a 30-inch forward space would be required at that 36-inch height countertop. It must, that 36-inch height accessible portion applies to the full depth of the counter, and that if there was security glazing or some type of window at this sales and service counter to separate the patron from the employee, that there be a way or a method to facilitate voice communication back and forth. Slide 81. Slide 81 has a figure of an individual in a mobility device that is sitting near a locker and trying to reach a locker, and also shows a dressing or fitting room bench. It does require that access be provided to at least 5% of each type of locker in each cluster, and that it have a minimum of 30 to 48 inch clear floor space, that the elements that are required to be accessible, that 5% of each type, have elements within the reach ranges, and that they have operable parts that are usable per Section 3 that would require it basically as a closed fist with no tight grasping, pinching, or twisting of the wrist, and also that there be an accessible bench provided. And I'm going to highlight some of the characteristics of that accessible bench in the upcoming slide. Slide 82 shows an individual in a mobility device entering a dressing, fitting, or locker room, and it's an individual room, and it shows that the door can swing through the clear space, similar to what we talked about in a toilet facility, that as long as there is a place outside of the swing of the door, a clear space of 30 by 48 inches, outside the swing of that door for the individual in the mobility device to be able to get out of the way of the swing of the door, that door can swing through the turning space. Slide 83 shows that this changing bench is found in Section 9903, and it requires that that clear floor space be parallel to the short axis of the bench. The size of the bench is 42 inches minimum, and it could be longer than 42 inches, but there is a depth requirement that is a range between 20 and 24 inches. These changing benches are used to get one's clothes on. They're used to transfer. They're not used to sit on. They're used to try to get your swimsuit or try to get your sweatpants or try to get your dress clothes back on so that you could go back to work. And for many people that use a mobility device that don't have use of their lower extremities, this bench allows them an opportunity to lay down and roll from side to side and maneuver their clothing back on, transfer, dry off, and then groom themselves and get back into their mobility device. Slide 84 shows some of the requirements of this bench. Back support, the back support has to start no further than 2 inches maximum from the seat. The back height has to be a minimum of 18 inches. I think an ideal location for the changing bench is actually to back it up against the wall like we saw in the previous slide, so that you don't actually add a back to it, but you use the wall as the back. If you could put it into a corner, it again allows for persons without that trunk stability to be able to back into that corner and dress using both the side and back walls. The seat height is 17 to 19 inches. The bench has to hold a structural strength of a minimum of 250 pounds. And again, the bench has to be a minimum length, and the back has to be a minimum length of 42 inches. Slide 85. Where to direct your questions? In this graphic, we have both the logo for the Department of Justice and the Access Board. And so if your questions are about existing facilities, as Peggy highlighted earlier, we've given the 800 phone line for the Department of Justice Technical Assistance Hotline. If you want to talk about the implementing regulations and additional requirements, also contact the Department of Justice. If you want to talk about these guidelines, or the 2010 accessibility standards for new construction and alterations, Access Board staff is available Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday from 10 to 5:30 at 800-872-2253, or available by email at ta@access-board.gov, or you can get all the documents that I'm going to highlight here next at access-board.gov, and those are the recreation facility guidelines TA documents, and they are available free of charge by going to the Access Board's publication page. And we do have one on accessible sports facilities. It's the green one on the left. We have one for swimming pools, play areas, all eight chapters of the recreation facility guides. And finally, we are up to slide 87, and this is where you have an opportunity to ask us questions and us respond.
Okay, thanks, Bill. And I'll let him catch his breath here a bit and go back to some of the questions that we received during the presentation. One person asked about some clarification on slide 24, and this was the slide, even slide 23 and slide 24 were dealing with the safe harbor. And basically, let me just review this again. Basically, what the Department of Justice said with respect to existing facilities, they said if your facility met the 1991 standard, then you don't have to go and bring that facility up to the 2010 standard, because as Bill noted in his section, there have been some changes in the provisions, for example, for toilet rooms that weren't in the 1991 standard. So if your facility met the 1991 standard, you don't have to make the changes to bring it up to the 2010 standard. That changes, of course, if you do an alteration. If you do an alteration after March 15th, then you have to use the 2010 standard. Now, the other piece of that was, what about these new sections, which I covered, a lot of the elements and features that you find in health clubs and fitness facilities, those were all new. They were not part of the 1991 standard. So basically what's expected there is that you put these elements on your list of trying to remove barriers, readily achievable barrier removal if you're a Title III entity, or achieving program access of your Title II entity. So that's what the requirement is for for existing facilities. Let's see, we had another question about the space behind the 12 inches behind the transfer shower. The person said they would think it might need more and 12 inches behind the back wheel to line up the wheelchair to do a lateral transfer in the shower. I see the lines up with the person's shoulder, but then they would be transferring over the tire. Most people move closer to the edge of the wheelchair to avoid the tire during the lateral transfer. This would require more space behind the wheelchair to get the space needed to transfer around, avoid the tire. Well, this is a good opportunity. Yeah, I'll add one thing, and then I think Bill wants to add as well. You know, please keep in mind that most of the dimensions that you see included here are minimums. And, you know, we expect that where possible, you know, you can exceed spaces. And you're right, more space is going to provide more opportunity for transfer. And Bill, do you want to add on?
You're exactly right. That in that situation where you are, have a shoulder to alignment, it would require you to come up over the top of your wheel, and not necessarily ideal for most individuals to transfer. That you're going to want to come at a diagonal out in front of your wheel and transfer forward some, and it can be difficult with only that 12 inches provided to make that transfer up and over the top of that wheel. Again, as Peggy stated, it is a minimum. It does permit that lateral transfer, but a minimum of 12 inches behind that wheel is required. We received a question that says, can a counter be set at 42 inches in height with the lowered shelf at 36 by 6 inches out? And the requirements in the 2010 standards require that the accessible portion of the countertop shall extend the same depth as the sales and service countertop. So it's no longer permitted to have a two-tiered or, say, an accessible little ledge and an accessible counter at 42 inches. So it would require that the full depth of the sales or service counter be at that 36 inches for the full depth of the counter. We received another question that says, can you address accessible shower stalls with shower doors on them? And typically a shower door does not facilitate access, and it wouldn't allow for the clear floor space that's required and then allow for an individual to close or open that structure to use the facility. And so we don't specifically address doors, but we do require minimum size openings. And I think the only way you could really facilitate most of those openings is if there was no door involved and it was only a curtain.
There was someone else here that wanted some more of the details about the organizations that are working on making exercise equipment operation and instructions more accessible, and I'll repeat those since I might have gone a little too fast there. One group that's working on some standards in this area is the American Society of Testing Materials, ASTM. Another group that is working on this issue is the National Center on Physical Activity and Disability, also known as NICPAD. They have an inclusive fitness council. So those are two groups. They're actually working together, but in separate venues to really and try to improve usability, again, for people who are visually impaired and hearing impaired, and sort of promote this information to both manufacturers and users.
We received another question that talks about, please discuss how to determine swimming pool wall, i.e. curved pools adjacent to a full height fence, adjacent to a spa, etc. The requirement in the guidelines requires that there is a breaking point at 300 linear feet of pool wall, and that is measured along the edge of the pool wall, whether it's curved or rectangular, and it includes whether there's landscaping up against an adjacent building. It includes all the areas, even those that do not permit access in and out of the water. So you would count and measure the full diameter or the full length and width of the perimeter of the pool to come up with that calculation. And then you would determine whether or not you were at that breaking point of 300 linear feet of pool wall that requires either one or two ways in and out of the pool. Remember that the less than 300 linear feet of pool wall require at least one way in, and it has to be a primary way in. It has to be either a lift or a sloped entry. And that if it's over 300 linear feet of pool wall, you have other choices. But you still have to provide the primary means of access in and out of the water. And that would be either a lift or a sloped entry. You could duplicate the lift or slope entry again, or you could provide pool stairs, a transfer wall, or a transfer system. So you count all perimeter, all pool length, regardless of whether or not you can enter or exit the pool from that location.
Okay, and there was also a question here about the accessible route connecting to areas of sport activity. There is not an exception for the accessible route connecting areas of sport activity in terms of the firm, stable, and slip-resistant requirement. That exception is once inside the area of sport activity. So that connection, that route that connects the multiple fields in a sports complex has to comply, that accessible route has to comply with the technical criteria that are prescribed in Chapter 4. So there's not an exemption. The exemption is only when you're inside the boundary of the area of sport activity. And I think we're about out of time at this point, but I would encourage you, if you have questions that we weren't able to address, that you address those to that email address that Bill mentioned earlier. That's ta@access-board.gov. And we should be able to get back to you relatively soon. And at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Robin.
Great. Well, thank you very much, both Bill and Peggy, for a great series today. Lots of discussion. You can see on our end, we saw many, many questions, and I know that people still have issues and things, and we do encourage you to contact the Access Board as was indicated. We also invite you to a special section that we have that is being offered. I'm sorry, this next session is on September 1st, which is Section 508. It's a little bit of a shift and into the accessible technology arena, and the basics will be covered at that session with Tim Cregan from the U.S. Access Board. So we invite you to join us for that session. You can register at the accessibilityonline.org website. So again, we invite you to join us next month. You will receive an email shortly following this particular session, which will contain the link for the evaluation. We do value your input, and we really strongly recommend that you complete that for us. For those of you that have requested continuing education or certificates of attendance, once we have been able to verify your attendance, you will be able to download a certificate at the website under your account. So just check back there. And in addition, if you were part of a group that may have been participating today where maybe one person registered and there were multiple people in the room, and you want continuing education credits, please make sure that you fill out the form and send it back to our office that verifies your attendance. That's our only way to be able to do that. And that form is, again, available on the accessibilityonline.org website under continuing education. And if you have any questions, please call our office at 877-232-1990, both voice and TTY. Again, thank you, Bill, and thank you, Peggy, and everyone have a good rest of your day. To disconnect from the session, you can either close your browser or under the file drop-down menu, choose exit. Thank you.
Done.